Our speaker this afternoon is Dr. Ronald Madras, a professor of theology at St. Louis University, where he has taught since 1979. He received a doctorate in theology at the University of Tübingen, Germany, where he studied under Professor Joseph Ratzinger, now better known as Pope Benedict XVI. Dr. Madras has been involved in ecumenical and interreligious dialogue for over 30 years. For many years, he served on the advisory committee to the National Council of Catholic Bishops Secretariat for Catholic-Jewish Relations. He is the author of a number of scholarly articles and 7 books, his most recent being Ignatian Humanism, A Dynamic Spirituality for the 21st Century. A number of our faculty and staff have read that, and we had a discussion at lunch last week, and it is on sale right back there. The bookstore has a display, and you get the faculty staff discount, of course. Dr. Madras has lectured at Hebrew University in Jerusalem, Oxford University, and the University of Berlin. So please now help me welcome Dr. Ron Madras.
Thank you very much, Maureen, and Father Slagle for your kind words, and all of you for this invitation. It's really an honor to be here, and I'm really humbled. I feel I'm bringing coals to Newcastle. I've known Father Andy and Maureen for some years, and long admired their work. You may not realize it, but this is the Silicon Valley of Ignatian spirituality. All around the world, people's lives are being touched as they pray with the online retreat and with the daily reflections on the scriptures. I have in the past assigned my first year students to read those daily reflections to get a taste of Ignatian spirituality. There's obviously a bond between our two universities, St. Louis U and Creighton. We're members of the same Ignatian family. The origins of that family go back to September 1525, when two 19-year-olds found themselves assigned to the same room in St. Barbe College at the University of Paris. Pierre Favre, or Peter Faber, as his name has been anglicized, came from a family of sheep herders in southern France, the French Alps. He was a studious kid, introverted, often anxious, what today kids would call a nerd. Francisco Javier, Francis Xavier, came from aristocracy in northern Spain. He was a hail fellow well met, a good athlete, outgoing personality, made friends easily. Bright enough, but not especially studious. In other words, a cross between Joe Cool and a jock. Despite their differences in personality and backgrounds, the two roommates came to like each other, and they became good friends. And this was helped, no doubt, by the fact that Favre would coach Xavier for his exams. Their lives were typical for university students in that day, reading, lectures and drills, all in Latin, the monotony punctuated by the occasional feast day or sporting event. But all that changed 4 years later when Peter and Francis had another roommate assigned to them, a 30-something Spanish nobleman with a limp and a reputation for being very serious about religion. Just think. History was made by someone in residence life. Ignatius Loyola was a man with a vision, but he knew that he could not bring that vision to life alone, and for years he had been trying to get colleagues to join him. He found and then lost collaborators in his enterprise, first in Spain, then in Paris. In Pierre Favre and Francis Xavier, he finally found two companions who stayed with him. Four others also joined them. And they called themselves the Friends in the Lord and became the first Jesuits. Next month marks the 500th anniversary of the birth of those two roommates, Francis and Pierre. And this July is the 450th anniversary of the death of Ignatius Loyola. And here at Creighton and at Jesuit institutions around the world, presentations like this one are being organized to mark those anniversaries with an Ignatian Jubilee year, Jubilee 06. Now that's worth pausing to think about, because even a few years ago, such anniversaries would have meant all the Jesuits on campus getting together and celebrating with a nicer than usual dinner, at which Father Schlegel would uncork a few bottles of better than usual wine. Maybe faculty, staff, and students would be invited to a mass on the anniversary days themselves. And that would be it. But the Superior General of the Society of Jesus, Father Peter Hans Koldenbach, sees this year as a teaching opportunity. And Jesuits around the world are marking these anniversaries by including all of their collaborators, students, and friends in Jesuit institutions. The Ignatian year is being celebrated as a family event, and all of us here are part of that family. Father Koldenbach made that same point in person when he spoke to you here in Omaha about a year and a half ago, October 2004. I'm sure many of you heard him. And that's also worth pausing to think about. Now, the job description of a Jesuit Superior General calls for him to meet regularly with provincials, to travel around to the various provinces of the Society of Jesus, and meet with the priests and the brothers. Coming here to Omaha was nothing new, but meeting and talking with all of you folks, faculty, staff, the trustees, students, meeting with the benefactors of the university, various Jesuit enterprises, that was new. Now, Father Koldenbach, humble man, modest man, he's the Black Pope. In Rome, he's called the Black Pope because he has more influence than anyone else except the Pope in his white garb. I mean, there are 80 cardinals, but only one Jesuit general, with now, 20,000 Jesuits around the world. But coming here and speaking to you, I think made an impression on Father Koldenbach. He realized, and even Jesuit generals can have their horizons expanded, that he is called to be a pastor, a mentor, a guide, not only for 20,000 Jesuits, but hundreds of thousands of men and women like us who are part of the Ignatian family, who identify with Ignatian spirituality, with the Society of Jesus and its enterprises. I think Father Koldenbach coming here realized he's got a much bigger job than he ever realized. The point has been made that the Society of Jesus was founded not by one man, but by a group of seven companions. Ignatius would not be remembered today. You wouldn't have that beautiful statue of him today were it not for Pierre Favre and Francis Xavier and the other companions who joined him. And their early enterprises, from housing the homeless to opening schools, would never have gotten off the ground without non-Jesuits supporting and working with them. Jesuit enterprises have always been, and still are, dependent on a shared vision and shared companionship. Back in the 1990s, I was at a meeting at Loyola University in Chicago. It was a Heartland Conference, and the Heartland Delta Conference is a group of colleges and universities who, in this Heartland Delta area, where faculty come together and talk about being part of the Ignatian enterprise. A SLU colleague of mine was there, the late Father Bill Stauder, and I remember there, we were waiting for a meeting to start. He pointed to the window, and he said, out there, you know, is the rocky shoreline of Lake Michigan. He said something like, you know, we could change that shoreline to sand, but the local fathers won't give us a permission. It was the we and the us that struck me. Because Father Bill's daughter was a Missouri province Jesuit who had spent his entire academic career at St. Louis University. And as far as I was concerned, Loyola Chicago was competition. But here he was talking about Loyola in terms of the first person plural. It was just a brief exchange. But that conversation with Bill Stoddard got me thinking and really changed my perspective. Because if he was part of something bigger than St. Louis University, then so was I. Jesuits have a sense of being part of something really big. They put out an annual that gives a taste of what the society is doing around the world. You want to get a couple copies of those and leave them on desks so people can glance through them. It makes the Jesuits feel connected. But when you think about it, we are no less connected. Jesuits no longer own their universities and colleges. Lay boards of trustees do. And you faculty and staff don't just work at the company store, you are the store. And the future of Creighton University depends no less on you than it does Father Schlegel and the other Jesuits who work side by side with you. In other words, the Ignatian family is not just Jesuits. And it's not just Catholics. Father Koldenbach made that clear in his talk here. There are Christians of other churches, Jews, Muslims, members of Eastern religions, and of no particular religious tradition, who have espoused the Ignatian vision and values as faculty, staff, students, alumni, trustees, and benefactors. And the operative word there is espoused. Because it's not automatic, just being an alumnus here of Creighton or working here at Creighton. I think you have to embrace it. What the Jesuits have done, what Father Schlegel has done, what Father Andy and other Jesuits have done with this meeting, is to invite you to embrace this vision and to consider yourself intentionally, you know, part of the Ignatian family. Our public relations office at St. Louis University likes to boast that we go back to 1818, making us the first institution of higher learning west of the Mississippi. Your origins here at Creighton go back 60 years later, to 1878. But that makes no difference. Because we both can boast a pedigree that goes back over 450 years ago, to 1548. That gives both of us a heritage that reaches back 88 years older than Harvard's, 150 years older than Yale's. Our Jesuit heritage reaches back to the Renaissance. And what that means for our institutions can be described by looking at the three men whose anniversaries are celebrating this Ignatian year. For they are in many ways emblematic of the vision and values that make Creighton and Jesuit education what it is. Ignatius, Xavier, and Fabre were creatures of their culture. And it was a Renaissance humanist culture. Let me dwell on that a little bit. Let me unpack that. When we hear the word Renaissance, we tend to think of art and architecture, Michelangelo's David, Raphael's Madonnas, the magnificent Dome Cathedral in Florence. All of them were inspired by the artistic monuments and heritage of ancient Rome. But the Renaissance, literally rebirth, got its name not because of the rebirth of art, but a rebirth of appreciation for the literature of ancient Rome, an attempt to imitate its elegance. The word humanist today tends to be identified with secularity, atheism, a rejection of religion. But the word first arose in 15th century Italy, where the umanisti were the teachers and writers of classical Latin literature. In contradistinction to the theologians who studied divinity, the professors and students borrowed a phrase from Cicero and called their discipline the studia humanitatis, what today we would call the humanities or liberal arts. Most Renaissance humanists were school teachers and speech or letter writers for civil authorities. Learning to speak and write well, they believed, required studying and imitating the elegance of authors like Cicero and Seneca. And of course, the lingua franca, the international language in those days, was Latin. The humanists were not critics of religion, but of medieval education, the so-called scholasticism that dominated the universities. The humanists despised the wooden Latin of the Summas in favor of the literary classics of Roman antiquity. They were aficionados of the classics. Now, besides the Latin, the Renaissance humanists criticized medieval education for being too cerebral. Petrarch, the father of humanism, faulted Aristotle for forming the mind without inflaming the heart. A proper education should enable students to love virtue and not just define it. The humanists believe that good literature produces good persons. And here you have the roots of the Jesuit partiality for the liberal arts, the ideal of educating the whole person, insisting that information and skills tie to values, and the integrating vision that is part of Creighton's mission statement. Studying classical authors like Cicero and Seneca, who were orators and statesmen, the humanists embraced the idea of cultivating a life of civic virtue, a sense of responsibility for church and society. The ideal end product of a Renaissance education was someone skilled in eloquence, who could move an audience to reform their lives, who could shape public opinion for the common good. You can see here, too, why Jesuits have always located their institutions in the heart of cities. Jesuit schools have never been ivory towers. From the very beginning, their aim was to provide value-driven leadership skills. Soon enough, their high regard for the literary style of the Latin classics extended to their contents as well. Along with the Bible, Renaissance humanists began to quote Cicero and Seneca and other classical authors for the value of their ideas, all of whom, of course, were what we used to call pagans. The humanists believed in the universality of truth, that wisdom exists beyond any particular doctrine or philosophy, beyond any religion or culture. The humanists cited and valued truth wherever they found it. One final characteristic of Renaissance humanism deserves a mention here. I mentioned already that the ideal product of a humanist education was a skilled orator, somebody who could move an audience with eloquence as well as argument. In those days, as much as today, rhetorical skill required the ability to think on one's feet and, if necessary, improvise in order to accommodate to one's audience. The need to accommodate to an audience led, naturally enough, to an appreciation of the need to accommodate to changing circumstances in any situation, including a culture. Here you have the Renaissance roots of another of Creighton's values, the wisdom to innovate. Now, what an apparently incongruous conjunction, wisdom, a value associated with old age, and innovation, a talent associated with youth. But the Renaissance was precisely a bridge between the Middle Ages and a changing world, reaching back but looking forward. What does any of this have to do with Ignatius Loyola or the Jubilee year we are marking this afternoon? I mentioned earlier that Favre, Xavier, and Ignatius were enrolled in the College of St. Barbe at the University of Paris. And the University of Paris at the time was going through a culture war, a clash between proponents of the older medieval style of education and the humanists who favored the newer curriculum based on classical literature, the liberal arts. The College of St. Barbe was committed to the newer humanist education. Ignatius, Francis, and Pierre were all products and eventually purveyors of a Renaissance humanist education and the cultural ethos it created. Creighton's dual commitment to wisdom and innovation is precisely the kind of expansive ethos the Renaissance humanists appreciated. So let me look at these three jubilarians whom we are honoring this afternoon. Ignatius, you all know the main outlines of his early life, a scandalous youth, a shattered leg, a long convalescence that culminates in a conversion experience that changes his life. I've always been impressed by his passion and determination. After his shattered leg was reset a second time, some of the bone protruded. And Ignatius was vain. He insisted that the surgeons cut away the flesh and the excess bone without anesthesia. He was a very tough hombre. I teach a course based on my book, Ignatian Humanism, in which we study several Jesuits who exemplify Ignatian spirituality. And last year, at the end of the course, I asked the students if they identified with any of the Jesuits we studied. I was amazed at how many chose Ignatius Loyola. And I was puzzled. Why would these 20-somethings identify with him? Frankly, I wouldn't have lunch with him. It was just too intense for me. Until I thought about the situation of these young people in that class. Many, if not most of them, are at a crossroads. Unlike me, but much like Ignatius. They're doing a lot of thinking about what to do with the rest of their lives. First convalescing at Loyola, and then for 10 months in the little town of Manresa, Ignatius thought and daydreamed a lot about what to do with the rest of his life. In the course of that time, he had a series of profound religious experiences in which he came to believe that God was teaching him like a schoolmaster. He began, like a student, taking down notes, began jotting down the lessons into what would become the spiritual exercises, a book about various ways to pray. One day, sitting on the banks of a river that ran next to Manresa, watching the water below, he realized that everything we are and have is like that water below. It comes from God and returns to God. That everything we have is a gift. And that God is busily at work in all of it. That God is present and at work in all our lives. In all our labors, that you can find God in all things and in the flurry of everyday life. That means nothing human is merely human. No common labor is merely common. It means we live in a universe of grace. In the words of the Jesuit poet Gerard Manley Hopkins, the world is charged with the grandeur of God. Ignatius continued doing at Manresa what he had begun doing during his convalescence. Prayed and daydreamed and listened. And in that deep stillness of his inner being, he became convinced that God was speaking to him. And he realized, if God would speak to a scoundrel like him, God will speak to anyone. We just have to take time, significant time, like he had, to quiet ourselves and daydream and reflect and listen. By quieting ourselves and listening carefully, we can find God's will in our deepest desires. This was one of the main purposes of Ignatius's spiritual exercises, to help people discern and decide what to do with the rest of their lives. Ignatius convinced Pierre Fabre and the others to take 30 days off to quiet themselves, to pray and daydream and look into their deepest desires. He directed them in his spiritual exercises. And what they found in their deepest desires, what they decided to do with the rest of their lives, was to work ad maiorem Dei gloriam, with the greater glory of God. But that, they also decided, was to be found in helping souls, a quaint way of saying helping people. Helping people meant helping them, too, get in touch with the God present in their lives. But it also meant looking at the world as it is and seeing what needs to be done and then doing it. Looking to do the greater glory of God meant looking to discern and serve the greater good of humankind. There's an old joke, but if you haven't heard it, then it isn't old, about a Franciscan, a Dominican, and a Jesuit priest, all saying their breviary, their prayer book, under a light when the light bulb burns out. The Franciscan takes out his rosary, begins praying his beads. The Dominican closes his eyes and meditates. And the Jesuit gets up and changes the light bulb. The early Jesuits worked in hospitals and prisons. They gave people the spiritual exercises. But obviously not everyone could afford to take off 30 days from their responsibilities to family and their professions. And here is where Ignatius's humanist education came in handy. Accommodate. In the early pages of the spiritual exercises, Ignatius lists a number of notations or instructions. One of them, the 18th, states that the exercises should be accommodated to the person making them, to their education, their age, their state of life. The 19th annotation states that persons who cannot take 30 days off from family or work can make the exercises over the course of several months, doing them for an hour or so a day. I'm sure that many of you here have made weekend retreats or even 8-day retreats, but I would like to make an unsolicited testimonial, make a pitch here for anyone who has not already done so, to make the entire spiritual exercises, the so-called 19th annotation retreat, or the spiritual exercises in everyday life, as they're called. You can inquire from Maureen or Andy about the program here on campus using their high-tech program. As conceived by St. Ignatius Loyola, the exercises are the proto-ministry of the Society of Jesus. And certainly anybody who really feels that he wants to be part of the Ignatian family, if they possibly can, to make that retreat. In their early years, Jesuits changed light bulbs. They housed and fed the homeless in the course of a difficult winter in Rome. They started halfway houses to help exploited women to escape the net of prostitution. They helped to reconcile feuding Italian families. And when Ignatius was invited to send some Jesuits to Messina in Italy, in Sicily, to open a school for boys, he readily agreed and sent some of his very best men. As a product of a humanist education, he believed that schools were a splendid way to make a difference in the lives of the students, their families, and ultimately society. The Jesuits soon found themselves invited to open schools everywhere. By the time Ignatius died in 1556, 500 years this July, they were operating schools from Portugal to Poland. The point to be made here is that the kind of education they offered was the same kind they had received from their own humanist teachers, one centered on the classics, one that imparted information, but also values and ideals. You know, there were attempts to change the curriculum, but the Jesuits resisted it. It's been said that their motto was, better to read first-rate pagans than second-rate Christians. Now, what does that mean for Jesuit education, particularly as it's practiced here at Creighton? Well, foremost, helping students to think about the rest of their lives. But in our terribly individualistic culture, it also means, in the phrase made famous by Father Pedro Arrupe, the previous general of the society, educating men and women for others. As found in your own mission statement, that slogan, by the way, has been expanded, accommodated, to avoid any hint of condescension and to emphasize a need for human solidarity. It's men and women for and with others. If Hurricane Katrina taught us anything, it is that there is no survival without solidarity. It was under the leadership of Father Arrupe that the Society of Jesus rearticulated its own mission in terms of the service of faith and the promotion of justice. And all of its enterprises were to be characterized by this hallmark, including, and maybe even above all, higher education. Ignatius Loyola is emblematic of a vision to serve God by making a difference, changing light bulbs, discerning what most needs to be done, and then doing it. In this light, a Jesuit education is, again, in the words of Creighton's mission statement, one which pursues truth. All universities do that. But also fosters values of competence, conscience, and compassion, forming students who will be willing to make a difference, who are willing to lead. Francis Xavier, if Ignatius Loyola is emblematic of a vision, Francis Xavier exemplifies the global outreach of that vision. Xavier was the first Jesuit missionary. Like other Catholic missionaries of that time, he thought he was doing a good thing, bringing not only Christian faith, but also a superior Western culture to the poor benighted natives, first in India and then Indonesia. But then Xavier traveled to Japan, where he was impressed by a high culture entirely different from his own. Now, contrary to legend, Xavier was not a great linguist. As I said, he was bright enough, but he wasn't a fantastic student. But he had this terrific outgoing personality that people found attractive, so that even with his broken Japanese, people would listen to him. After a year, he and a convert set out on foot for Kyoto to seek an audience with the emperor, whom he hoped to charm and then convert, and with him all Japan. He was dressed in his shabby black priest cassock, which he was very proud of, kind of symbolic of his vow of poverty. When he got to Kyoto, he learned that the emperor had no power, that it was the local barons, or daimyo, who really ran the country. Now, on his way to Kyoto, he had been received kindly by one such local baron, the daimyo of Yamaguchi. Xavier asked for a second audience, but this time he appeared not in his shabby black Jesuit habit, but in fine silk. He presented the daimyo with gifts and letters of recommendation written on illuminated parchment. In return, the daimyo gave him permission to preach about Christianity in his territory. Xavier did not realize it, but in exchanging his shabby priest's cassock for fine silk, he was pioneering the way for future Jesuits like Matteo Ricci, who exchanged his habit for the silk garb of a Confucian scholar. Jesuit missionaries in Japan went on to build mission houses built as pagodas, outfitted with a special room for the traditional tea ceremony. They believed that Japanese Christians should be able to feel at home in their new faith, which meant translating that faith into their own language and culture. Now, the story of Jesuit missionaries learning foreign languages and accommodating to foreign cultures is another talk for another time. But it arose from an Ignatian spirituality that insists on profound respect for the individual person and accommodating the spiritual exercises to the state and needs of that individual. And if one accommodates to a person, then one must learn to accommodate to that person's culture. Now, what does all of this mean for Jesuit education? The term global village is a cliche, but it captures the world in which we live and the tomorrow for which we are preparing our students at St. Louis University in Creighton. And Creighton is well positioned to do it because it belongs to a global network, not only of 28 colleges and universities in the United States, but 168 faculties of higher learning worldwide. Here at Creighton, you are connected with the Dominican Republic. We are sending students down there. An immersion trip is going to El Salvador. Those kids are learning about the world we live in. The Ignatian family reaches back to the Renaissance, but also around the globe. We are part of the world's first multinational corporation. But unlike Walmart, we're not for profit. We're for changing light bulbs, making a difference. Obviously, the focus on Jesuit education is no longer Cicero and Seneca. We have accommodated. Our liberal arts curriculum exposes our students not just to Latin classics, but world classics, to the whole broad range of human learning and the achievements of human ingenuity. In the best Renaissance tradition, Jesuit liberal education believes that truth is where you find it. And so too is the good and the beautiful, to be valued and celebrated no matter where they came from. When Ignatius determined that we could find God present and at work in all creation, later Jesuits unpacked that statement to realize we can find God in all human hearts, including those of people who are not Christian. God labors in people's lives without their necessarily knowing it. Jesuit missionaries realized that they were not bringing God to people. They were simply making those people more aware of the God who was already there with them. And that's why Jesuit colleges and universities are not known for proselytizing, trying to make Catholics out of Jews, Muslims, Hindus, or Buddhists. We try to make them better Jews, Muslims, Hindus, Buddhists, in short, better human beings. And that's why your mission statement says that Creighton celebrates diversity, not just tolerates it, but celebrates it. Pierre Favre, the least known of our three honorees, yet he was the first companion to persevere with Ignatius. He had a lot to do with Xavier overcoming his initial reluctance to get too close to Ignatius. Favre suffered from serious bouts of anxiety and depression. He had an obsessive-compulsive neurosis about sin and guilt, scruples. Ignatius had suffered the same malady for a period of time while at Manresa. And he was able to recognize it in Favre and to help him deal with it. Under Ignatius's direction, Favre made the spiritual exercises and achieved some peace of mind. Now, Favre was not a great administrator like Ignatius or a missionary to exotic lands like Xavier, but he was an expert at giving the spiritual exercises. Ignatius said Favre was better than he was. Toward the end of his life, Favre wrote a memoir, the story of his life, in which he thanks God that Ignatius entered into it. And time and again, Favre uses the words consolation and conversation. Consolation, because that's what he himself experienced through these spiritual exercises, and conversation because that's what he did most when directing spiritual exercises. One of the signature trademarks of the Jesuit way of doing things is conversation. And the difference between conversation and debate is listening, a word which comes from the word to list, to bend over, to bend so as to hear better, to lean so as to hear better and understand and appreciate better. Ignatian spirituality is a spirituality of listening. The spiritual director listens to the retreatant so that the retreatant can better listen to God and the deepest desires of her heart. And so too, Ignatian pedagogy is one of listening. Your mission statement says that students at Creighton learn through dialogue and from reflection and experience. That's a long way from the long, boring lectures I was exposed to in college, but I didn't have the advantage of a Jesuit education. I had to learn Ignatian pedagogy on the job. But that's a whole other conversation, isn't it? Are we faculty exposing our students to Ignatian pedagogy of conversation and reflection? We need a conversation about that. If Ignatius symbolizes a vision and Xavier the global outreach of that vision, Pierre Favre represents the spiritual dimension of that vision. Visit any bookstore and you will discover that spirituality is a hot topic these days. It's because spirituality, in its broadest sense, has to do with what fills your sails and drives you, What lifts your heart? What animates you? What holds you together? What gets you up in the morning? And if you properly note, gee, shouldn't spirituality have something to do with Holy Spirit, with God? Then I would say, sure. But let me quote my favorite quote from Martin Luther. That your God is what you hang your heart on. So what do you hang your heart on? These are questions our students ask, unconsciously if not explicitly. And at Jesuit colleges and universities, we're not embarrassed to address them. And not only with courses in theology or with programs offered by campus ministry. In Jesuit colleges and universities like Creighton, students learn about the Bible in theology classes, but also about evolution in science classes. They meet theologians who embrace evolution and scientists who believe in God. They meet students of other faiths and of no apparent faith. And if we do our job right, they learn that grace and faith and God's presence have more to do with what's in your heart than with the ideas in your mind. There's something else that Pierre Fabre symbolizes for me. The fact that even shy, nerdy people can make a difference as part of a community. And the fact that there is no end to the amount of good you can do if you don't care who gets the credit. Fabre doesn't have any churches named after him. But I really wonder if we would remember Ignatius Loyola or Francis Xavier were it not for that quiet, shy college kid who was the first to share Ignatius's vision and to persevere and to bring his roommate along with him. But Fabre would never have accomplished anything memorable alone as an individual. He was able to make a difference only because he was part of an enterprise bigger than himself. Because he was part of the Ignatian family. His example should encourage us. There's not much that we can do as individuals, but as part of institutions like Creighton, as faculty, staff, students, friends, supporters, there's a tremendous difference that we can make not only in our students' lives, but in our society. As members of the Ignatian family, this Ignatian year, it's a good time to realize how singularly blessed we are to belong to an enterprise and a heritage that is as old as the Renaissance, even more global than Walmart, one that allows even ordinary folks like us to make an extraordinary difference. It's a heritage worth celebrating, and I am pleased to be here with you to celebrate it. Thank you.